At this time, I would like to formally begin today's call and introduce Dave Wetherington.
Thank you, Eddie, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dave Wetherington. I'm the project manager for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Great Lakes and Mississippi River Interbasin Study, otherwise known as GLIMRIS. I'll be serving as the primary speaker and moderator of this call. For those of you who are from the media, my last name is spelled Wetherington, W-E-T-H-I-N-G-T-O-N. Thank you for joining us today to discuss the Great Lakes Mississippi River Interbasin Study Report, or GLIMRIS report, that was sent to Congress by the Secretary of the Army for Civil Works. In a few moments, Brigadier General Margaret Burcham, commander of the Great Lakes and Ohio River Division of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, will provide a brief introduction of the Corps efforts in GLIMRIS and then turn the call back over to me. General Burcham's name is spelled M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T-B-U-R-C-H-A-M. We have about 1 hour for this call, which will include a question and answer period at the end. We'd appreciate it, since we have a large number of folks on the line, if you could limit yourself to one question and one follow-up, and if time permits, we'll ask for any additional questions. When you do ask a question, please state your name and affiliation prior to asking a question so that we can be sure that you receive the proper follow-up. As Eddie mentioned, this call is being recorded. You should be able to find the report online at glimrs.anl.gov. We had anticipated having it up by about this time today. Due to a couple technical issues, we're launching a new website. In addition to posting the report on the website, it should be up momentarily. So the report, the summary report, and all associated documents probably will be online sometime during the duration of this call. Also, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And now I'll turn the call over to General Burcham.
Thank you, Dave. And thanks to all of you that are attending this conference and joining us today. The Corps has been involved in the Aquatic Nuisance Species, or ANS, fight in the Great Lakes region for decades, and we take the job very seriously. GLIMRIS is a complex study and looks at prevention methods for several ANS, not just fish or Asian carp. Today marks the culmination of a tremendous amount of hard work that the GLIMRIS team has put into this complex study over the past several years. All of the products that we've released to date have contributed to the significant body of knowledge contained in the GLIMRIS report. These products include reports on baseline data, such as an inventory of the established ANS of concern in both basins, an inventory of available potential ANS control technologies, and statistics on fishing and navigation usage in the study area. The purpose of the GLIMRIS report is to paint an objective picture of several alternatives and to offer decision makers and stakeholders the information about those alternatives. The GLIMRIS report does not make recommendations, nor does it prioritize the plans. This report is unique as compared to most Corps of Engineers reports in that it identifies a range of options and is adaptable for the incorporation of future technologies. The USAIDS team, which encompasses Corps experts from across the country, has worked painstakingly on this report and in unprecedented close coordination with federal, state, local, non-governmental, and tribal stakeholders. It is our goal to ensure that congressional, regional, and public decision makers are well informed on various ways to prevent the transfer of ANS through the Chicago area waterway system in order to protect our natural resources. Now I will turn the call over to GLIMRIS Chicago Area Waterway System Project Manager, Dave Wetherington, who will discuss the report in detail.
Thank you, General Burcham. And actually, for those of you who are joining us who have access to the web, while General Burcham was speaking, I received notice that our new GLIMRIS website is online and the GLIMRIS report itself is online. Please feel free to go to our website at glimrs.anl.gov and select the tab that says GLIMRIS Report. There you will find all of the GLIMRIS Report related documents and particularly the summary of the GLIMRIS Report. That document would be most helpful to pull up during today's conference. As Congress directed, the Glimmers report focuses on prevention methods for the Chicago Area Waterway System, analyzes hydrologic separation, and was reported to Congress today within that legislative deadline. Data collection for the Glimmers report consisted of three major tasks. The first was identifying potential connections where species could transfer between the basins. The second was identifying species of concern established in one of the basins with risk of transfer to the other. The third was identifying potential technologies to prevent the transfer of those species. The team then assembled this and other pertinent baseline data that General Burcham mentioned to create the range of alternatives that is presented in the Glimmers report. These plans may be hard to visualize as I go through them today, which is why we have that summary report available on the Glimmers website. Please feel free to pull it up now and follow along. The Chicago Area Waterway System is the main focus of the report, as it is the only direct and continuous connection between the basins. We also do mention, in brief, in the report, the other connections which are in what we call Focus Area 2, along the basin divide, the watershed divide between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River Basin. You can also find additional information about efforts in Focus Area 2 on the Glimmers website. The Glimmers report identifies 8 potential alternative plans, ranging from continuing current efforts to complete separation of the watersheds. It also evaluates the potential of those alternatives to control the interbasin spread of 13 aquatic nuisance fish, algae, virus, crustacean, and plants in all life stages with high or medium risk of interbasin transfer. Of these 13 species, the Glimmers team identified 3 to include the silver, bighead carp, and scud that are established in the Mississippi River Basin with the risk of transfer to the Great Lakes. And similarly, there are 10 species spanning a range of fish, plants, algae, and even a virus that are established in the Great Lakes with risk of transferring to the Mississippi River Basin and having similar adverse impacts. Over 90 possible ANS controls were initially identified by the team. They are then narrowed down based on a variety of input and criteria, including public comment, based on their effectiveness, availability, and implementability. The controls that emerged from the screening process were incorporated into the alternative plans presented in the Glimmers report. There were a number of technologies that emerged as potential choices, but those that were effective at controlling the movement of the species in the waterway were the technologies that were selected for inclusion in the formulation of an alternative. More specifically, the team examined how species move through the waterway, swimming, floating, or through assisted movement, like on the hull of a barge, and identified those technologies that are effective at controlling those methods of movement. In the end, the team developed concepts that included a unique flushing lock structure, which we have termed the Glimmers lock, an electric barrier system, ANS, aquatic nuisance species treatment plants, and screen sluice gates. The technology alternatives in the Glimmers report include a combination of all of these controls. The team also considered several hydrologic separation alternatives that use physical barriers to stop passage of untreated surface waters, thus controlling the transfer of ANS. While you've likely heard of a number of these measures or can conceptually envision how they may function, the most novel development from the study is the idea of the Glimmers lock. The way this concept works is a vessel enters the Glimmers lock and the sector gates will close behind it. Then, a pump-driven filling and emptying system removes water from one end and on the opposite end fills the lock with water, clean water. The pool for vessels is maintained during this lockage. The clean water is pumped in as an inflow, flushing and replacing the water originally in the lock, which is being pumped out at approximately an equal rate. Now, this clean water has really been treated for aquatic nuisance species, which is why we call it the, quote, clean water. The ANS treatment plants supply the treated water to the Glimmers lock. These treatment plants are based on commonly available wastewater and drinking water technologies and utilize a combination of screening, filtration, and ultraviolet, or UV radiation, to supply the ANS treated water stream for the Glimmers lock. This Glimmers lock concept is designed to be effective at controlling aquatic nuisance species that can float in the waterway, such as algae and plants. The addition of electric barriers in tandem with the Glimmers lock further reduces the risk of aquatic nuisance species transfer by applying an electric field in the water that repels and stuns fish, deterring their entry into the lock chamber. The electric barriers in the Glimmers alternatives would be purpose-built, enhanced by the experience already gained through the operation and maintenance of existing barrier systems and tuned specifically for the ANS of concern identified in Glimmers. Each of the eight alternative plans that are presented in the Glimmers report includes a general location, conceptual designs, estimated implementation time, and cost information. The Chicago Area Waterway System is a very complex series of waterways. The cause is used for navigation, water supply and conveyance, flood risk management, and recreation. Therefore, each plan also includes potential mitigation measures and estimated costs to offset those adverse impacts or uses to the system. Mitigation measures evaluated address those potential impacts to navigation, flood risk management, water quality, and natural resources. The plans that are presented in the GLIMMIS report differ in how effective they are for different species and how long it may take to accomplish the full risk reduction after implementation. The alternatives outlined are also generally effective for the categories of species, so a technology suited for a type of fish, for example, could be reasonably adapted and also be effective on another type of fish. I'll now provide a brief description of the 8 alternatives presented in the GLIMMIS report. Alternative Plan 1 assumes that the current and previously planned future actions for aquatic invasive species control will continue without any additional GLIMMIS controls. These alternatives serve as a reference point or a baseline condition, if you will, to compare the remainder of the plans presented in the report. We call this the No New Federal Action or the Sustained Activities Alternative. Alternative Plan 2 includes aquatic nuisance species controls that do not require construction of any kind of a feature and may be implemented relatively quickly. Examples include chemical control, netting and herbicides, as well as other best management practices, including public education and the implementation of new policies and regulations. Non-structural measures, as we call them, are not anticipated to have a significant impact to waterway uses and users, but are only effective for some fish and plant aquatic nuisance species. The estimated annual cost for a full suite of non-structural measures is estimated at around $68 million annually. As many of the non-structural measures represent best management practices for aquatic nuisance species, a full suite of non-structural measures and their associated costs are also included as a component in each of the structural alternatives presented in this report, alternatives 3 through 8. Alternative Plan 3 focuses on maintaining current operations of the Chicago Area Waterway System with a minimal number of control points. It includes non-structural measures and 2 single-point ANS control technologies consisting of a GLIMMIS lock, lock channels, electric barriers, and ANS treatment plants constructed at 2 mid-system locations in the Chicago Area Waterway System. The way this works is the normal flow of the cause would be diverted from the channel on the lake side of the new locks through aquatic nuisance species treatment plants at each location, then discharged back to the riverside. Essentially, you're treating the volume of the river at each point. The new locks would remain closed at all times unless a vessel is needed to pass through the system. Because of the topography of the Chicagoland area, and the ability and the use of the Chicago Area Waterway System for flood risk management, significant flooding could result from this alternative without the appropriate mitigation. Therefore, 3 new GLIMMIS reservoirs and associated conveyance tunnels would be constructed to mitigate additional flooding risks. Estimated completion time for this alternative is about 25 years, with a first-time capital cost of about $15.5 billion. Alternative Plan 4 focuses on maintaining current operations of the cause by creating an ANS-treated buffer zone within the cause. So this is similar to Alternative Plan 3 in that it implements technologies. However, whereas in Plan 3 looked at single points for ANS control, this plan looks at one-way control points either at Lake Michigan or downstream near Joliet, Illinois, at Brandon Road Lock and Dam. The buffer zone, as we call it, is a segment of the Chicago Area Waterway System between the lakefront and the Brandon Road Lock and Dam, which is located adjacent to Joliet, Illinois, just southwest of Chicago. Various combinations of GLIMMIS locks, electric barriers, and ANS treatment plants would control the one-way downstream passage from Lake Michigan at 5 points adjacent to the lake. A single control point would then regulate one-way passage upstream at that Brandon Road Lock and Dam. In this measure, or in this alternative, 2 new reservoirs and conveyance tunnels will be constructed to mitigate additional flooding risks. This alternative also includes physical barrier on the Grand Calumet River at the state line between Indiana and Illinois, and on the Little Calumet River at Hammond, Indiana. This buffer zone, as we created, allows for backup control points in the system in a region which ANS response actions could occur as necessary. Estimated completion time for the full two-way risk reduction for this alternative is about 10 years, with an approximate cost of $7.8 billion. Alternative Plan 5 hydrologically separates the watersheds along the lakefront through a strategic placement of physical barriers at Wilmette, Chicago, Calumet City, and Hammond. Stagnant conditions and other water quality impacts would be anticipated near the dead-end reaches of the cause where physical barriers would be placed. Therefore, ANS treatment plants are used to treat the ANS treated, are used to bring the ANS treated water from Lake Michigan to improve water movement and quality. Without mitigation, significant flooding would result from this alternative, so two new large glimmerous reservoirs and the necessary conveyance tunnels would be constructed to offset additional flooding risks. Estimated completion time for this alternative is about 25 years, with a cost of approximately $18.4 billion. Alternative Plan 6 is similar to Alternative Plan 5 in that it hydrologically separates the watersheds. However, this is a mid-system point through barriers located near the towns of Stickney and Alsip, Illinois. These locations are near the historic basin divide prior to the urbanization of the Chicago region. Significant water quality impacts from the treated discharges, combined sewer overflows, and non-point runoff would result from this alternative without the appropriate mitigation. To offset these water quality impacts, three new glimmerous reservoirs and several conveyance tunnels would be constructed. This plan also includes remediation of contaminated sediments that would now be open to Lake Michigan. The estimated completion time for this alternative is about 25 years, with an estimated cost of approximately $15.5 billion. Alternative plans 7 and 8 represent hybrids of technologies and physical barriers. Alternative plan 7 combines technologies and physical separation barriers to minimize impacts to existing Chicago area waterway system uses and users. It includes three physical barriers located at Stickney, Stateline, and Hammond that will hydrologically separate four of the five aquatic pathways between the two basins. Three new glimmerous reservoirs and conveyance tunnels would be constructed in this scenario to mitigate for flood risk and water quality impacts. Estimated completion time is about 25 years, with a cost of approximately $15.1 billion. Alternative Plan 8, similar to 7, also combines technologies and physical barriers. This time, the physical barrier is included ALSEP, that would ALSEP, Illinois, that would hydrologically separate three of the five aquatic pathways between the two basins. Two new glimmerous reservoirs and several conveyance tunnels would be necessary to mitigate additional flooding risks. Estimated completion time for this alternative is 25 years, with an estimated cost of $8.3 billion. Alternatives presented in this document would require congressional authorization in order to move forward with federal implementation. Additional activities would also have to be completed on any of these potential alternatives prior to any implementation. Tasks such as state, agency, and public review, as well as the completion of legal requirements, including the National Environmental Policy Act, would need to be completed. Core-specific activities, such as model certification and independent external peer review, may also need to be completed as appropriate. As aquatic nuisance species control is a shared responsibility among federal, state, and local agencies, as well as the public, continued participation by stakeholders is essential to reach a decision and authorization for a collaborative path forward. As I highlighted over the past few minutes, there are many complexities inherent to modifying the various important existing uses of the Chicago area waterway system. Therefore, implementation of any plan to further control aquatic nuisance species transfer would require significant resource allocation by other federal agencies and state or local stakeholders in order to achieve that joint solution. In order to promote a dialogue toward this collaborative path forward, the engagement of regional stakeholders will continue to be a focus of the study team after the release of the Glimmerous report. A public comment period opened today and is open through March 3rd, 2014. We will be hosting 7 public meetings throughout January across the region to discuss the contents of this report. Please visit our website at glimmerous.anl.gov for meeting locations and dates. Our tour will kick off January 9th, which is this Thursday, in Chicago. As the conversation continues, collaborative groups such as the Asian Carp Regional Coordinating Committee will likely continue to play a significant leadership role. Continued partnerships among government and regulatory agencies, project stakeholders, and regional leadership will facilitate coordinated efforts toward the protection of aquatic and environmental resources and shape future decisions regarding long-term ANS strategies. I'll now turn the floor over to questions. As a reminder, please state your name and affiliation prior to asking a question, and we appreciate you limiting your speaking time to one question and a follow-up.
Yeah, this is Tom Henry from the Toledo Blade.
Hi there, Tom.
I want to make sure you could hear me. Although I know you're not making recommendations per se or setting priorities with these, in your assessment with this report, which would you feel is the most effective, because a lot of this is probably going to come down to cost-benefit. Even if you haven't done a cost-benefit analysis, which of these would you consider the most effective?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think that's something that's going to have to be continued to be discussed among the wide group of stakeholders that that share this responsibility for ANS control. In the Glimmers report, we provide a number of different evaluation criteria, and some of them do include total project cost, annual O&M costs, as well as relative effectiveness of the different controls. And so I think that what stakeholders will do is look at those costs and look at those other, perceived benefits and try and find that balance. It's really difficult for us alone as the Corps of Engineers to answer that question, since the responsibility for aquatic nuisance species control is really a shared responsibility.
A quick follow-up, too, on the public hearing process. The Maumee River is one of the it's the most productive area for spawning fish, and it's highly suitable for Asian carp. Western Lake Erie produces the most fish. I'm wondering why you guys chose not to have a public hearing in Toledo. Most of the fishermen in the most active fishing area on the lakes launch between Toledo and Sandusky, but you've chosen Ann Arbor and Cleveland.
Mm-hmm, sure. And we chose the meeting locations based on response from some initial scoping meetings we did a number of years back for Glimmers. We really wanted to try and reach out to regional stakeholders. Given this kind of environment of budget constraints and travel constraints, we'd love I'd love to go to every little city around the region and be able to speak to all of the interested stakeholders. But we just had to make some decisions with regard to where we might get essentially the most bang for the buck. And we hope that that those who aren't able to join us in person can listen in either the Chicago or the Ann Arbor calls. We'll offer both of those with webinar, so telephone and web conference capability. The way that will work is that those who are at the meeting specifically, we'll get the opportunity to ask questions first, and then we'll turn it over to those who are joining us virtually.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Up to Darcy Egan, the Plain Dealer, Cleveland, Ohio. We're looking at 25-year implementation schedules for most of the plans to put some kind of infrastructure in place on the Chicago waterway system. Why 25 years? I mean, how are you coming up with a 25-year plan when it doesn't seem that much infrastructure is going to be put in place?
Sure, that's an excellent question, Darcy. And, a lot of the information is within the report, but what I want to offer today is that I completely agree that building a separation or a dam in the waterway would not likely take 25 years. However, because of the complexities of the Chicago Area Waterway System, and especially those associated with flood risk management and water quality, there is significant mitigation or compensation, if you will, that is necessary to ensure that we do not have adverse impacts on the way the system operates today. We cannot imagine building a structure in the river that would add additional flood risk for the millions of residents of the Chicagoland area, nor would we want to build something that would significantly contaminate the waters of Lake Michigan, since we're trying to protect them in some sense here. So the 25 years is not for the duration of building the actual dam or the actual ANS control technology in many cases. It's building those reservoirs and tunnels necessary to offset those adverse impacts and which must be brought online before that risk reduction can be achieved?
Yes, this is Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist based in Overland, Ohio, near Cleveland. This study, it looks as though, to me, I'm just looking at it now, of course, for the first time, as though it really focuses on the Chicago entryway into the Great Lakes region. But, of course, there are many other aquatic pathways. As Tom Henry mentioned, the Maumee River is one. We have, however, here in Ohio, recently seen four reproductive grass carp found in Sandusky Bay, and nobody knows where they came from or even what the impact is. I noticed that among the carp you mentioned, the grass carp was not listed, and I'm wondering if there is anything in this plan that helps to address some of the concerns about the carp that are already being found in Lake Erie.
Sure. A number of good questions there, Karen. Let me speak to the regional focus of the report. This report was being authored in specific response to legislation that was enacted in July of 2012, which asked us, among a number of things, to focus in on the Chicago Air Waterway System. Now, that being said, we have continued to move forward with a lot of great work in what we call the Other Aquatic Pathways region, our focus area too. On the website, there are 18 different aquatic pathway reports that speak to the probability characterization of each of those pathways for forming and for subsequent transfer of local aquatic nuisance species. For a couple of select locations, specifically Eagle Marsh being one of them, we also have a controls report on the website that discusses methods for controlling the potential transfer of species, and there's actually many steps that have been undertaken to date toward implementing those kinds of controls. Now, with regard to grass carp and focusing on the Chicago Air Waterway System in Glimmers in general, grass carp were not included as one of the ANS of concern because of the information regarding the availability or the presence of these species on both sides of the basins. However, if you wanted to look at methods to prevent more movement of these invasive species, the controls that are developed in Glimmers that we have provided in the Glimmers report do address those swimming species. And so we believe that any of the controls that are listed in the report could be adapted as appropriate, especially in the Chicago Air Waterway System, or other types of controls may be adapted as appropriate for these other potential pathways.
And where would I find that information again?
The information on the Other Aquatic Pathways report is on our Glimmers website. You can either search Glimmers on Google or go to Glimmers, G-L-M-R-I-S, .anl.gov, and there will be a tab for Other Aquatic Pathways or Focus Area 2, where you can view each of those 18 reports as well as those ANS control reports for the other pathways.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for your interest.
Hello, this is Elizabeth Brackett from WTTW in Chicago.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm trying to look through this quickly, as everyone is, but I'm wondering, overall, how many of the eight alternatives include physical barriers, and how many include just a physical barrier, and how many don't include a physical barrier, and where it looks like the Glimmers lock is brand new. How did you come up with that, and why was it developed?
All right, Elizabeth, of the eight alternatives, six include some type of physical barrier at some point in the system. The reason that for that being is that the Chicago Air Waterway System is very complex, and you know, there are aquatic pathways that connect the two basins, but they're used for very different things. For example, if you're familiar in the Chicagoland area, the Grand Cal and Little Calumet River are not so much for navigation, especially right around the state line, which is where we would implement physical barriers and then the necessary mitigation features for any type of induced flood risk or water quality risk. Now, so of the eight alternatives, six include some application of physical barriers, and two, the lakefront and the mid-system rely solely on the application of physical barriers. The second part of your question, I'm sorry, Elizabeth, what was the, refresh my memory?
First lock, how did you come up with that, and
yes.
Why did you come up with that?
So we, the Glimmer's lock concept is new, and it's probably one of the more interesting ideas that has come out of this study. You know, very basically, the concept is to replace the volume of a lock chamber with ANS-treated water. So basically remove water that has aquatic nuisance species in it, and that's really to address those species that float in the waterway. So primarily algae, plants, or maybe even early life stages of fish, like larvae or eggs. The concept was based on a traditional lock, a navigational lock concept, and we wanted to make it as simple as possible while still being effective at affecting that ANS control, that bringing about that risk reduction. There are other methods that could potentially be used to treat a lock chamber, such as the introduction of some kind of a, like a chlorine or some kind of a disinfectant, but we found that the potential side effects, including human health and safety, disinfection byproducts in the waterway, et cetera, really kind of screen that away from having this being the most elegant and kind of simple method to essentially try and replace the water within the system of the lock to achieve a 99.99% risk reduction.
And were you figuring that Asian carp would not have made it up to that point because of the electronic barriers before, or could they be caught in this too? And is this in use anywhere else in the world?
Correct. So the first part of your question, yes, we would use, we would pair glimmerous lock concepts with electric barriers depending on the orientation. So for alternative three, the glimmerous lock would be bookended on either side by electric barriers, or for the one-way concepts like you see in alternative four, you would have a glimmerous, you would have a electric barrier on one side of the glimmerous lock from which you are trying to prevent the one-way transfer of species. So the electric barrier and the navigation channel associated with it would be targeted at stopping those aquatic nuisance species that swim, so the fish essentially. Once you have that measure along with the glimmerous lock, which controls those species that float in the water column, that's how you affect that greater risk reduction than you get with just an electric barrier alone. There are no glimmerous locks that are in use at this point in time. However, the concept, which I won't get into a whole bunch of detail about, the concept is very commonly applied in chemical engineering study and practice with regard to plug flow within a process type system. So the idea is not unheard of by any means. It's used at a very commonly a much smaller scale and was verified by our Engineering Research Development Center as a feasible way to potentially remove aquatic nuisance species. However, that being said, there would still need to be significant more study that would be done to identify the lockage times, the flow rates, and all the details behind it. Yes.
Hi, this is Paul Marion from Green Chicago Business. I have a question about the costs. There's a couple of different charts and so forth in the appendix on the cost engineering, and I'm wondering which one is the best one to use. The one that's it ranges from like $7.8 billion to $18.3 billion. Or there's another one that goes all the way up to $25 billion.
So the first set that that you discussed are the most appropriate ones to use. Those are the ones that are used throughout the Glimmer's report and the summary report itself. Now, the cost engineering appendix goes into a lot more detail, and I'd recommend really carefully reading through all of that before you use any of the numbers that come through there. But the 7.8 to about 18.3 billion is the range, is a good range of alternative costs for the physical alternatives to be constructed. We did also include $68 million a year for those non-structural measures. And again, those costs are further broken down both in the summary report and in the main report to elements within each different alternative. You'll notice, as I spoke to earlier on with regard to the mitigation, a lot of these scenarios, there'll be significant costs for, you know, offsetting those adverse impacts captured by those mitigation costs, as opposed to the actual cost of the controls themselves. And those are broken out in tables in the summary report as well as in tables in the Glimmers report.
Okay, and so that figure, let's say, of $18.3 billion is in 2014 dollars, and that's over 25
Correct.
Years? And that's over 25 years.
Correct. And so you bring up another good point here. You know, these figures are they are conceptual cost estimates. Now, we did use a very a thorough risk-based cost estimating methodology to come up with them. However, we did make several assumptions. Some of those assumptions include, you know, sufficient funding commensurate with project needs over that 25-year basis. You know, any kind of infrastructure project where you're talking about the multi-billions of dollars, there is some sort of cost risk associated with that in terms of receiving necessary funding. We also made assumptions that everything would kind of work like clockwork with regard to permitting and other environmental reviews, et cetera. So with time comes additional cost. So these costs are best used to compare amongst the plans themselves to help make a decision in terms of a path forward. These costs should not be considered as absolute ultimate long-term costs for implementing an alternative unless it's under the very best of conditions.
And if I could just ask one more question, how does this compare to the cost of the existing McCook Reservoir deep tunnel project? Just in dollars and order of magnitude.
Bill, these costs are actually very similar, and the existing work that was being done for McCook and Thornton were used as a basis for creating these costs. I mentioned we did like a pretty substantial cost risk process in developing these, so we were able to scope out how much does it cost to construct a large reservoir, how much does it cost to construct large tunnels, and have a certain contingency applied to each of those based on the relative amount of knowledge that we have.
Okay, but $18 billion is similar to the cost of TARP?
Well, that if you were to size the reservoirs similar, you would you'd note that TARP reservoirs that you're probably referring to range in the size from maybe 5 to 7 or 10 billion gallons. Some of these range up to 15. Also, this includes additional tunnel and sewer network infrastructure as well as a number of additional costs.
So these would be bigger reservoirs than TARP?
Yes.
Okay.
Some of them are. In some scenarios, they are. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, this is Tom Ichniowski with Engineering News Record magazine in Washington. A couple of specific questions.
Tom.
Can you isolate the cost of the Glimmers lock for me? That seems to be the largest single component. Is that right? And roughly what's the ballpark design and construction cost of that? Excluding the operation cost.
The Glimmer Slack, you can drill into that cost engineering appendix to get that specific cost. You know, as a quick back of the envelope, it's probably in a range of $1 to $2 billion for a Glimmer Slack, depending on where it's constructed. That's kind of the ballpark estimate. We can drill down into the details. All that information is included in that cost appendix.
Right. And do you have any sense at all about what the cost share on this would be? I'm assuming that the pick your number, $60 million to $18 billion, that is not all federal money, right? What would be a rough breakdown, federal, non-federal? Any idea?
Sure. That's an excellent question, and you know I'm kind of hesitant to speculate because that is very much subject to congressional authorization. You know, traditionally, Corps of Engineers ecosystem restoration projects, which this would likely fall under something similar, are cost shared at a 65-35, 65% federal, 35% non-federal. But as you noted, there are components of each of these scenarios that would very likely be 100% non-federal, as well as components that would potentially be cost shared, again, depending on that congressional authorization.
And one other quick question. Using a 25-year horizon here, can you break that down a little bit? what would be the regulatory study, you know, approval and study phase? How long would that take? What, how long roughly would the construction phase take for the biggest item, for the biggest, the $18 billion option?
For the largest items, that 25-year time frame includes the full design and construction time frame. There would, as you mentioned, be some amount of additional study that would be necessary leading up to it, including environmental compliance, et cetera. All of our project timelines begin with a 2017 design kickoff date, essentially. So we anticipate that if, you know, if direction were received fairly quickly, that we could achieve a number of those environmental reviews going toward that 2017 date. Now, again, that's under the best possible scenarios, and any additional, you know, hang-ups or lags would add significant time and cost to that schedule. However, the 25 years is for a full design and construction.
Okay, and one quick note here before I proceed to unmute the next line. We still have a number of questions here in the queue. We would greatly appreciate it if you could keep your follow-up questions to a minimum. And a reminder to anyone who might want to ask a question, you may dial star 1 on your phone. You'll be notified when your line is unmuted.
Hi, it's David Shaper from National Public Radio. I'm wondering if you could say which of these plans, which of these methods would 100% guarantee that no invasive species would go between the two watersheds, and which would work best for the Asian carp in particular?
Well, David, that's a very interesting question, because with any of these particular alternatives comes some amount of residual risk. And residual risk can be explained in a number of different ways with regard to these alternatives in glimmerus. A couple that you kind of directly alluded to is, one, the residual risk with the effectiveness of the control technology itself. That being said, control technologies that prevent the water from flowing from each side of the basin would probably incur the lowest amount of residual risk. However, there's also significant residual risk with other vectors or other ways that species can transfer between the basins. It could be very likely that you could spend several million or billion dollars on infrastructure investments, such as any of these included within the report, and still have other ways that species could transfer between the basins, such as human-mediated transport, such as through bait buckets, or, you know, intentional transfer between the basins, or accidental transfer, some of the smaller species of concern, like through waterfowl movement, you know, algae moving from one side to the other. So you have residual risk with regard to the effectiveness of the control, and you have residual risk with regard to the other vectors, other ways that acquired nuisance species can transfer. Those are some of the primary residual risks with any of these alternatives.
So in other words, there is residual risk with all of these?
There is. Even if you were to, for example, construct a physical barrier in the system, you know, our analysis, our level of analysis, was to what we call the, quote, 500-year event. And, you know, that realizes that any kind of engineering structure has some point of weakness. If you have a storm or a series of storms that totally swamp the system, you could still get aquatic nuisance species transfer even with the implementation of a physical barrier.
Hi, this is Chris Engel with the Gaylord Herald Times in Michigan.
Hi, Chris.
My question, basically, people want to know what they can do to expedite this process, this fix. What is your best suggestion for getting people to motivate the powers that be to implement one or several of these fixes?
Let your voice be heard, Chris. That's I think that would be the best thing. Right now, we are implementing we're opening up a public comment period that's available to any member of the public through the 3rd of March, 2014. There are a number of ways you can relay a comment about any one of these alternatives on the report. You can go to the website, glimmers.anl.gov and select the link that lets you leave a comment for the record. You may also attend any one of the 7 public meetings that were coming up over the month of January and make your voice heard at that point in time. We also do have availability of receiving comments via mail or hand delivery. I think that continuing this conversation and engaging stakeholders, as I mentioned during the end of the call, is that aquatic nuisance species control is a shared responsibility. We can affect some kind of a physical solution, but unless it is kind of bought into by everyone, it's going to be very difficult to achieve success in ANS control.
Hello, this is John Flesher with the Associated Press. I was wondering if you could tell us what your thinking was in deciding not to put forward a preferred alternative, why you made that decision. There are members of Congress who seem to really be wanting that.
Sure. And I think that there's two reasons. First of all, original authority asked us to provide a range of options and technologies to prevent the transfer of aquatic nuisance species between the Great Lakes and Mississippi River basins through aquatic pathways. So that specific language, the range of options and technologies, certainly implied that perhaps a single recommendation was not necessarily feasible. In addition, the concept that aquatic nuisance species control is a shared responsibility is one that really we're trying to kind of expound upon the public and those who think that we should have made a specific recommendation. There are many aspects of these plans that require other federal agency or local stakeholder, even public engagement in order to successfully affect that type of an infrastructure solution. And so it kind of doesn't make sense for a single agency with the limited scope of authorities to make that specific decision. It should be the result of a larger collaborative, consensus-based path forward.
Okay. To follow up, I wanted to be sure, just following up on what you said earlier regarding the potential effectiveness of these plans, the argument that has been made by some in this all along has been that physical separation is the only sure way to prevent invasive species from migrating back and forth. Now, it sounds like from what you're saying that there is no such thing as an absolute foolproof system of any type, but would you say that the option that just calls for absolute physical separation, that any of those would offer a greater likelihood of success than some of those that would not, or would you not go that far?
Sure, John. Those scenarios that look at a physical separation have a potential to have the greatest amount of risk reduction because they could potentially reduce the risk of those three types of species from transferring. Those three species I'm talking about, the general way that aquatic species transfer them in the water column. They swim, they float, or they have assisted movement, so they will come across like on the hull of a barge. A number of the technology solutions will address the species that swim and the species that float, but will really leave those assisted movers unaffected. So physical separation does have the ability to really buy down the risk of all types of aquatic nuisance species transfer through that aquatic pathway. The catch with that, John, is the implementation time. There are some species that we have recorded presence in Southern Lake Michigan Basin in the 80s. And no additional information to date. So have those species already transferred or are they poised to transfer? And looking at the implementation times ranging from 10 to 25 years, could they potentially transfer within that time period? There are still a lot of unknowns specifically. So when you ask if there's an absolute scenario, I would agree with your statement saying that there is not an absolute, but there are different levels of risk reduction that can be bought by the different alternatives presented within the Glimmers report, and that ultimate decision is really up to that collaborative group of stakeholders.
Hi, it's Michael Hawthorne from the Chicago Tribune. I'm really curious, looking through this summary on alternative 4, it almost seems like what you're offering there is a compromise between the shipping interests that want the locks to remain open and the folks, especially in the other Great Lakes states, that want them permanently closed. Is that what you're trying to do there? And then also, If I'm a member of Congress, I'm looking at that particular plan compared to some of the other just straight-out physical separation options. You've got a quicker time until when it's completed, and it's cheaper. Aren't you essentially saying right there to the wider variety of interests involved that this is the option that the Army Corps actually prefers?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. The one-way controls that we envisioned in this alternative plan for, which is the, we call the cause buffer zone concept, what we tried to do was minimize the adverse impacts to those existing uses of the waterway system. So those uses being navigation, flood risk management, water quality, water conveyance. And so by minimizing those adverse impacts and trying to come up with a way to still try and buy down that that level of risk, so trying to achieve prevention to the greatest amount possible, that's how we came up with those one-way concepts. It is true that this solution could be built on a quicker time frame. It's also even further true, once you kind of delve into the details, that interim risk reduction, such as one-way risk reduction of species moving up from the Mississippi River to the Great Lakes, may be even achieved even quicker than that time, than 10-year time frame. However, there is, you know, some question about the technologies associated. They would need further investigation and development to, you know, basically ensure that they meet the risk reduction, which we believe they will. So we are not recommending that. Go ahead.
The charts there, even though you say the estimated time for the alternative to be completed, 10 years versus 25 years, in your chart on the in the summary, the reduction in risk is the same for Asian carp, at least.
That's correct. And that's because we believe
that...
Why is that?
If you complete it more quickly and yet the risk doesn't go away for 25 years, what's up there?
So basically, we look at a suite of potential controls, including non-structural measures that are implemented to help continue to maintain that risk at a lower level. So over the first 10 years, we believe that there are significant investments that are going on to date that will continue really targeted on Asian carp, since they are very high in that public psyche. Now, the chance of between year 10 and year 25 of that funding going down or the level of risk reduction changing, that there might be some fidelity there that we don't quite have, and that's just because that you have to make a number of assumptions based on a number of unknowns with regard to the potential passage of these species of concern.
Hi, this is Mark Garino with the Christian Science Monitor. Some of my questions were already answered, but I wanted to ask you two things. One is there's a number of invasive species mentioned in the report. How much does the Asian carp play into these alternatives? I mean, are there specific alternatives here that apply more for the carp because they're considered more of a threat to the Great Lakes than other species? And secondly, I know this goes to Congress, but can you give me a snapshot of the timeline we're talking here? Are we going to wait for a year from them to approve one of these measures? I know you're talking about going forward to 2017 for launching the design phase, but, you know, what are the next steps here in terms of the timeline? Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for your question, Mark. So with regard to the species threat, we did not consider one species rather than any other specific species. We looked at trying to achieve that prevention of transfer of all species, whether they come from the Great Lakes to the Mississippi River Basin or vice versa, like the Asian carp. So really, we tried to find the most effective technologies at preventing the transfer of any kind of species that swim, that float, or that are assisted movement through navigation and other types of. Now, with regard to the timeline, again, you know, we have provided some information to decision makers, and we certainly are standing by to move forward to the next steps. We believe, as I mentioned several times during this conversation, that, you know, acquired nuisance species control is a shared responsibility, and there needs to be a collaborative decision in the path forward because there are various authorities and appropriations and basically agency expertise that are necessary to move forward with any one or number of these alternatives.
Brian Francisco with the Fort Wayne, Indiana Journal-Gazette. You earlier mentioned Eagle Marsh. I've been looking over the report to see if there's an update from August about the proposed berm reconstruction projects. I don't see anything. Can you tell me if anything has changed? You were looking at two different reconstruction projects or a possibility of blending them.
Right, Brian. And the reason you don't see it is because the congressional authority that this GLIMR support was created under asked us to specifically look at the Chicago Area Waterway System. The most recent updates with regard to Eagle Marsh or Focus Area 2 would be on the website with regard to that aquatic nuisance species controls checklist, or I'm sorry, the ANS for Focus Area 2, the ANS controls paper for Eagle Marsh. We can also have our programmatic manager, Jack Jolet, get a hold of you, who has a little bit more knowledge with regard to those topics specifically outside of the Chicago Air Waterway System, specifically within the Fort Wayne, Indiana, Eagle Marsh region. But I would look first to the website for the most up-to-date information. It will be separate from the GLIMRS report as the report looks specifically at the Chicago Air Waterway System.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, this is Tom Henry from the Toledo Blade again. I know that you're not making, of course you're not making recommendations to Congress per se, but you had to winnow it down to eight alternatives here. And in so doing, you've got a range of years up to 25 years for some of this construction. Is there really a belief within the Corps that Asian carp and other species could be held at bay for at least 25 years? As you said, there may be more planning and research going on before construction even starts. And well, I'll just leave it at that first. I mean, what kind of engineering analysis that I'm sure the time frame had to be taken into when you're coming up with an engineering solution that you're up against a time frame, you're up against what some people perceive as a crisis right now at hand and you know, concerns about how well the electrical barriers are working. How much faith do you have in believing that the 25 years system won't be dramatically changed by then anyways?
Sure, and that's a very real possibility. I don't think that we can say with certainty one way or the other. I think that what's going on right now is that we are continuing to develop and enhance our existing barrier systems as well as constructing our new permanent barrier system, which we believe is effective at controlling the transfer of those adult Asian carp species. Now, we do have a risk assessment within the GLIMRS report that speaks to the likelihood and the amount of uncertainty related to those likelihoods of being able to control any kind of invasive species. And so there is significant uncertainty associated with that. Now, the 25-year timeline wasn't, it wasn't created in the sense that we know we could certainly manage any species within that time frame. It's the amount of time necessary to create, to construct the significant infrastructure that would be necessary in order to achieve the end solution that a lot of stakeholder interests have been asking us to pursue, and we were specifically asked to pursue within this authority. That 25 years is how long we think in a best-case scenario it would take to construct the infrastructure necessary to either you know, prevent significant contamination of water quality or to prevent significant flooding for the residents of the Chicagoland area while achieving the physical barrier solution.
No, but wouldn't you have to account for that time frame while you're coming up with a viable engineering solution? Because you know, if it's true that the carp, most of the carp that we know migrating up the Mississippi escaped confinement in 1995, even that, it's been 19 years. We don't, and the Mississippi River and the Illinois River and everything else has been dramatically changed. We don't know how the system is going to look like in 25 years if it takes that long to engineer this. So I guess I'm just asking if that time frame isn't part of the ultimate engineering solution.
Sure. And you know, we were asked to look at hydrologic separation specifically as part of the authority. And so we really, you know, put pen to paper and tried to give our best kind of conceptual guess at how long it would take to implement a hydrologic separation alternative. And now I think what you're asking is, can we do that in enough time? Can we do it quick enough? And the answer is nobody knows, I don't think. We are fairly certain that with optimal funding and, you know, under the best case scenarios, we could achieve a hydrologic separation scenario in about 25 years. Is that going to be in time? Your guess is probably as good as anybody else's with regard to the uncertainties and the variabilities that exist with regard to natural species, such as Asian carp or any other aquatic nuisance species.
Real quick follow to, if there is construction, you know, whether it's complete hydrological separation or some other kind of construction, does the Corps believe there still would be a need for $68 million a year in chemical and other treatments, or is that strictly if there is no construction at all? In other words, with the construction, whatever construction alternative that might be chosen, would that be entirely without the need for 68 or some other some other type of millions of chemical and other treatment?
Sure. So I think what you're referring to is our non-structural control technologies, and we've included non-structural controls as best management practices for every single one of these alternatives. The reason we've included them is because they help to buy down risk, and it's not just with chemical treatments. It includes things like inspection of and cleaning of watercraft. It includes, you know, public education about bait bucket transfer. These are things that are good ideas to take away from this. And that $68 million a year, that is, I think, probably the conservative, the high amount that may be necessary to come up with. We will try to pull the different states and look at how much they spend on their existing aquatic nuisance species management plans. And based on that information we received from a number of different states with regard to education and outreach, monitoring, watercraft inspection, et cetera, in addition to application of pesticides, that's where we came up with that $68 million a year. And I believe, that's probably a fairly conservative number. There's probably efficiencies to be gained in this and in any other one of the alternatives presented in the report. If it's something, but we feel that, you know, non-structural measures, these best management practices are a good idea, whether you're building a structural solution or not. Educating the public, you know, advocating for new laws, those are all good ideas.
So even if there is construction, then you feel that there could be a need, whether it's $68 million or some other figure up to that, that there would still be a need to do some of this then?
Absolutely.
Yes, my name is Ned Dickman with Great Lakes Boating Magazine and the Great Lakes Boating Federation. I just came a little late to this conference, but I haven't heard much about the recreational boating community. There are some 6,000 boaters in the Chicago harbors, and I would estimate about 20 to 25,000 in the Chicagoland band that are accustomed to using the locks, and some of them do engage in the grand tour going to the Mississippi and into southern waters. Among the three options that you talked about earlier, could you tell me if anyone is a little bit more friendly to the boating community? Would this hydrological separation rule out any voyaging into the Mississippi from the Great Lakes? Could you please elaborate on that?
Sure, Ned. With the two different hydrologic separation alternatives, there'd be potentially different impacts to recreational boaters. lakefront hydrologic separation would really limit the amount of ability for boaters from the lakes to get into the river system and vice versa. We did consider some mitigation with regard to that, or offsetting those adverse impacts, and the need to potentially include more recreational boat storage along Lake Michigan proper, as opposed to going down to dry docks, as a lot of the users do today. With regard to the ability to actually transfer between the two systems, it would be very unlikely, if there are physical barriers, that that could take place. That being said, there are, of the eight alternatives, at least six of them that have some sort of provision where that movement of recreational and commercial cargo navigation could still continue.
Hi, this is Mark Peters with the Wall Street Journal. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Mark. How about yourself?
Good, thank you. Quick question. The one thing I didn't completely get out of the report and was curious if you could explain to me is the flow of the Chicago River. Under some of the scenarios, would it reverse back to its natural state, or would it continue to flow toward the Mississippi under all scenarios?
In the majority of the scenarios, we would continue the flow away from Lake Michigan, really to protect the water quality of Lake Michigan. In the hydrologic separation scenarios, specifically in the mid-system, the part of the Chicago River that is from that midstream barrier lakeward would now be open to Lake Michigan. However, there would not really be any kind of natural source of flow, so there would likely need to be some kind of additional engineering structure like a flow recirculation or something to keep that waterway from becoming stagnant. In terms of quote-unquote restoring it to how it used to be, after over 100 years of development in the Chicagoland area, it's going to be very difficult to restore the marsh that Chicago used to be back to where it was. So there are, in the majority of the scenarios, the river does continue to flow down toward the Gulf of Mexico ultimately, although there are some that kind of change where that breakpoint happens.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. A related question to what Ned was asking, I think, but it's American Waterways operators out with a press release in the last hour talking about wanting to protect the free flow of waterborne commerce. Would you say then that six of these still do, or how would you respond to that push by the barge operators and others to protect their interests?
Sure. I would say that a number of the scenarios that we provided do maintain that ability to navigate the system in one way or the other, whether that's for commercial or recreational navigation. So, yes, in fact, there of the six alternatives, one of the six being a do-nothing alternative, which obviously maintains everything as it is today, six of the eight alternatives do maintain the ability to navigate the system in some manner.
Hi, this is Gary Wilson, Great Lakes Echo in Chicago. And my question relates to this study that the Great Lakes Commission and the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative did a couple of years ago. And I believe their numbers were for physical separation were in the $3 to $9 billion range and a much seemingly simpler scenario. I understand the scope of your study was much more comprehensive, but I wonder if you could give a comment on their work as it relates to yours.
Sure. I mean, I think what the Great Lakes Commission and the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative did was begin the conversation, and they were very effective at doing that. The scenarios presented in their report were not to the same, I guess, engineering level of design as our report was. We spent several years modeling the system itself as well as the associated sewer networks and looking at associated water quality impacts and the like. There are a couple of differences between the level of analysis that the Great Lakes Commission and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative achieved, and I think the biggest one is their level of analysis for what kind of storm level they're looking at. They designed to the, quote, the 100-year storm versus ours was designed to the 500-year storm. And the reason why we chose the 500-year storm event, if you will, Liz, because over the past 5 years, we've had at least three, if not four, specific occasions where we've met or exceeded that 100-year storm event. Now, if you remember, a little while ago, I spoke to residual risks and the ability for even a physical barrier to be swamped under the proper natural conditions. So since our intent was to try and prevent the transfer, we wanted to look at being protective of that that water flow, in the, especially within the hydrologic separation scenarios. You also quoted the price as around 3 to 9. I think it was probably closer to 4 to 10 billion, which that's, you know, a billion here, a billion there. But with regard to their estimates, they looked at up to 100% greater was their kind of contingency. So up to 50% less or 100% greater. So that number, that range could be anywhere from 2 billion to 20 billion. And so I believe that, you know, considering all the variables, that the estimates are probably pretty well in line what we produced here at the Glimmers Report.
Thank you.
Hello, Javier Stern with Illinois Outdoor News. Just asking and wondering if you can explain who actually will make the call on this and determine one of these eight alternatives, which one to step forward, and what the timeline is for that. I know it's been talked about a little bit, but it's still not clear to me. Is it Congress's call, or will the Army Corps actually go through all the public comment and all the different comments that comes in and make a call there?
We are going to collect public comment for essentially to support an administrative record. And I believe that our congressional stakeholders, as well as, you know, the rest of the Great Lakes and Mississippi River stakeholders, will have the ability to look at those public comments and see where folks are most interested in spending our taxpayer dollars. With regard to the Corps of Engineers specifically, we require two things, authority and appropriations, in order to move forward on anything. And so if we were to move to implementation on any one of these potential scenarios, we would require the necessary authority as well as the necessary appropriations to continue to move forward.
Will the Corps at some point set forth a preferred option?
Acting alone, it is unlikely that the Corps of Engineers would do that, and the reason for that is because, as I spoke to several times, the idea, the concept that aquatic nuisance species is a shared responsibility. Now, we do have the ability to work with a non-federal partner or a consortium of non-federal partners under our existing study authority to perhaps flesh out one or more of these alternatives in greater detail. However, that that would need to be kind of a collaborative type of a solution toward getting, you know, making more formally a recommendation.
Hello, it's Elizabeth Brackett from WTTW.
Hi.
Hi, good. So my question is similar to what I asked originally. When the fellow from the shipping industry called, or the recreational boating industry called, you said that there were six alternatives, or the eight alternatives, that would allow either recreational or commercial shipping. Now, when I'm looking on page 9 of the summary, strategies used in each Glimmers alternative, it looks to me like it's 5 through 8, which would be 4, that do have a hydrological separation. So if there is a hydrological separation, how would either recreational or commercial shipping be allowed?
Sure, sure. And that's a great question. That kind of goes back to the complexity of the Chicago Area Waterway System. There are 5 different connections between the Great Lakes and Mississippi River basins in the Chicago Air Waterways. They all flow down eventually through that sanitary and ship canal and connect to the Illinois River. However, if there is a hydrologic separation on perhaps one or two of those 5 points, navigation may still continue on the balance of those waterways, of those channels within the Chicago Air Waterway System.
So which ones are those?
All right, so you've got there are 5 points at which the waters have the opportunity to mix. Starting up in the north, you have Wilmette.
Which of the alternative plans that show on your little chart on page 9 a hydrological separation,
sure,
which would allow boating to pass through?
Plans number 7 and 8.
Thank you. And one more question. You keep saying the Army Corps of Engineers can't act without authority. So that's congressional authority, correct? So this would have to be authorized by Congress before any of this could begin.
That is correct. All right. Thank you. I have just for everyone's information, the spelling of my name, again, my name is Dave, D-A-V-E, last name Wethington, W-E-T-H-I-N-G-T-O-N. I am the project manager for Glimmerus here with the Chicago District Corps of Engineers. I appreciate everyone's time and interest and significant interest in this call today and your interest in Glimmerus. We hope to see you soon at a public meeting in Chicago or otherwise near you. As always, feel free to keep in touch with us via our website, glimmerus.anl.gov, and follow Glimmerus on Facebook and Twitter. With that, thank you so much for your time and interest in Glimmerus, and I look forward to speaking with all of you soon. Take care.